Chapter 11. The Overlook was a large room with a step floor, numerous seats and tables, and a set of vast angled windows stretched across one wall. Beyond the windows was a grey gloom, hard to resolve in any detail, but with faint suggestions of depth and slow, grinding movement. A woman stood with her back to us, facing the window. She was tall and imperious in her stance. She had her hands laced behind her back, her legs spaced, her shoulders squared.
"Something illicit used to take place here, is our best guess,"
were the first words to come out of her mouth.
"That's why the shielding is so effective. The people who constructed this environment wanted whatever happened within to remain a secret. Whether those activities constituted a consensual sport or a form of coercive entertainment is lost to us now. It was all far too long ago. But we should be grateful for their thoroughness.
Their security measures have protected us long after the wolves rooted out every other human hiding place in these ruins."
Her voice was slow, measured, and extremely deep. Even when she fell silent, the lingering force of her words seemed to deny permission to speak. I wanted to say something, but I was dry-throated, my intentions stalling between thought and deed. She carried on, still not turning around.
"I am Lady Arek. You may call me that. I have had other names, some longer, some shorter, but this one satisfies me for now. My mother was a soldier, my father a revolutionary. I was conceived within the influence of the Hades Matrix and carried to term in the artificial womb of a half-sane conjoiner, whose name means damage, in a tongue now long forgotten. I carry within me traces of all my antecedents, including those who passed forever into the Hades Matrix. I am, therefore, both a scientist and a scholar. I have lived 100 human lives and felt the death agonies of 1,000 civilizations lost to the inhibitors. I have seen worlds burn and suns shrivel. I have walked on bones and breathed the dust of the dead. I have wept. Some think me insane, others that I might be a goddess. I am neither of those things, but I am most certainly not to be underestimated."
She began to turn.
"You will not wrong me, William, or disappoint me. I would caution against it."
The shorter, squatter figure, who had been standing next to the woman, also with his back to us, said,
"So you know, this is a light, easy-going side."
Lady Arek had turned to us. I saw a human woman with nothing about her to suggest any obvious genetic or prosthetic augmentation. Yet authority blasted off her like a cold, shrieking wind, finding every loose chink in my soul. I had never been in the presence of another person with such a commanding will. I could not guess her biological age, but I sensed that she had taken no steps to make herself appear youthful. There were lines around her mouth and eyes, a hollowness under her chin. Her hair was black, turning to grey, and she wore it combed back from her forehead without ostentation, and secured by a plain clasp that I had seen when she faced the window. Her deep-set eyes were pale and piercing, though, and all the more striking for the plainness of her features. The manner of her was judicial, as if any ornamentation or vanity would have been not only out of place, but disrespectful to her station. Only her coat offset the impression of severity. It was long-hemmed, high-collared, and marked in blue, red, and white, with a cross-shaped motif imprinted diagonally across her back. Beneath it she wore a dark tunic, trousers, and boots. I wanted to speak for myself, but Lady Arek's gaze exerted a squeezing pressure on my windpipe. It took an immense effort to overcome that paralyzing influence. I was under the impression Glass wanted me for something. Lady Arek looked at Glass without answering me.
"Are you certain of his identity?" "As I told Snowdrop, the markers confirm it."
Lady Arek's companion was another hyperpig. He had turned around as well, regarding me doubtfully. From halfway across the room, he wrinkled his already well-wrinkled snout and wafted a hand in front of it.
"He stinks. Old man stink, love," Snowdrop said.
She was with us, but standing back with a certain deference to the commanding figure in the multicoloured coat.
"I know old man stinks, Snow, but he doesn't smell like Clavaine did."
"He's not the same man," Glass clarified.
"I'm not even sure he's the same species."
Pinky came closer. He was short, broad, pugnacious, and very obviously an old pig. There were scars as well as wrinkles, vying for space with each other. His left ear was little more than a fleshy nub, as if most of it had been ripped away. He had a sour smell to him, something lingering on his breath. I had not said a word to him, but I already felt as if I had crossed some line of invisible etiquette, failing to satisfy his expectations in the matter of some arcane, punctilious formality.
"Don't look like the old man either. Looks like something the old man would have chewed up and spat out."
His pink-tinged eyes narrowed.
"What's your game, exactly? Why'd you let Glass think you're someone you're not?"
"There's no game," Glass said. "He is the sibling. No great familial resemblance should be expected either. They were of different ages, before centuries of interplanetary and interstellar war took them on different trajectories, through vastly different subjective time intervals." I watched her, thinking how odd and pleasing it was to see Glass on the defensive, being forced to explain herself. "He is Warren Clavaine. His older memories are reconsolidating. He is coming back to the truth of what he is, in all its glorious ugliness."
"We shall verify," Lady Arryk declared, nodding slightly. "I do not doubt your essential account, Hourglass. You will have conducted the necessary biometric audits. You are nothing if not thorough. But there will be no harm in verification, using our independent genetic samples.
They will establish consanguinity."
"They will have to, because no other outcome is tolerable."
Pinky sidled even closer. He was measuring me up as if I were some dusty artifact left over at the end of an auction, something no one wanted.
"Not sure what I want to believe less, that he's an impostor who's hoodwinked us all, or that he really is the old man's brother."
Lady Arryk looked down at her companion.
"Why would you not want to credit the latter?"
"Because if those blood checks of yours prove reliable, we're really fucked."
Lady Arryk looked a little disconcerted by this outburst.
"How so, Pinky?"
"Look at the evidence. He might be cut from the same cloth as the old man, but the way he's standing there, shivering in his boots, letting Glass push him around like a sack of old meat, can't even find the balls to speak for himself."
He dismissed me.
"He's nothing."
"He is all we have," Lady Arryk said.
"I am Miguel de Ruyter," I said, forcing out each word like a hard, jagged stone. "That's what I know. All I know. I didn't ask for this, and I don't know the man you seem to think was my brother."
But, needled by the pig's assessment of me, I plumped my chest out and jutted my chin forward.
"But that's your problem, not mine.
My business begins and ends with Glass."
"Oh, tough guy," Pinky said, "and the nature of that business."
"Killing her," I said. Glass made a dismissive sniffing sound. Pinky turned away, sneering his disregard. Snowdrop was silent. The guards, Cater and Omori, brooded. Only Lady Arryk said,
"And what if she is too valuable to be allowed to die, Clavaine?"
I frowned. The eyes were as sharp and cold as ever, but some of their effect was attenuating through exposure. I thought of the men who developed an increased tolerance for snake venom through being bitten repeatedly.
"You called her Hourglass just now. That wasn't a slip."
"The name reflects her nature," Lady Arryk answered crisply. "Like me, she is a demi-conjoiner."
"A what?"
You know of conjoiners, if only from second-hand intelligence. Demi-conjoiners have all the usual gifts of their kind, but few of the restraints. We are none of us alike. Some of us came about by design, some by happenstance. And what of Glass? They found her, grievously injured, left for dead by her own supposed allies during a compromised military operation. With grace and kindness, and not a little self-interest, the conjoiners took her into their compound and rebuilt her broken mind, using experimental techniques. Since she was essentially a new person at that point, with only the thinnest thread still binding her to the past, they gave her a new name. It was not uncommon among conjoiners to adopt forms relating to timepieces or components thereof. Clepsydra, Remontoire, Hourglass. That is her true name. But she prefers the shortened form, imagining it distances her from her origin and nature. I looked at Glass. Is this true? After everything, you're a conjoiner.
I am no more a conjoiner than Lady Arryk is, Glass replied. Their methods touched us. I was useful to them once, but that doesn't make me one of them.
You travel alone, I acknowledged. Unusual for a conjoiner, from what I've gathered. They can't handle isolation from their brothers and sisters. It's worse than any sensory deprivation we can imagine.
Speak for yourself, Lady Arryk said. But you are correct about Hourglass. She is different, as am I. Better to think of her as an engineered instrument, a military tool. She was designed to act independently of the Mother Nest, without the neural support framework of other conjoiners. A sociopath by their standards, but useful in certain situations. They needed an assassin, an agent of death. She became the very personification. Her name, Death's Timekeeper. Her ship, Death's Implement. The hourglass in her hand, her scythe by her side, the mistress Death leads them on. Even her face, skull pale, a mask that both conceals and illuminates her nature. She is a work of art, as much as a weapon.
And you? I asked, feeling an unexpected bristling protectiveness towards my captor, the very woman I had sworn to kill. I hated Glass, but I hated hearing her belittled even more. You're better, are you?
I contain multitudes, Lady Arryk said.
Hourglass is defined by her conjoinerhood. For me it is merely a facet.
But she dipped her face, some tiny increment of severity dropping away from it.
Hourglass has been effective in the long run. You are testament to that, and we still have need of her. You will not hurt her, Clavaine, nor attempt to. You are useful to me as well, but not irreplaceable.
Well, I said, forcing a smile, now that we've gotten the warm civilities out of the way. Lady Arryk met my remark with indifference.
Have you immediate needs after your journey?
I don't even know what you want with me, or what Glass has already done. She mentioned stones. Gideon stones, whatever the hell they are.
She hasn't told you. I told him as little as he needed, Glass said. There was no point dwelling on the significance of the stones, until I had confirmation that they were in our possession.
Some boldness returned to her.
Are they, Lady Arryk? You've had 6 years. Tell me you haven't been sitting around doing nothing all that time.
Pinky dipped a stubby finger into what remained of his ear.
This is where it gets complicated, boys and girls.
Snowdrop moved nearer to his side. She reached for his hand, touching it for an instant.
Have you, or haven't you, secured the stones?
Glass persisted.
Secured is an elastic concept, Lady Arryk returned.
The stones have been extracted from the wreck at the bottom of the chasm. 9 in all. Sufficient for our needs.
What wreck? I asked.
Someone please enlighten him,
Lady Arryk said, touching a hand to her brow as if she might swoon from exasperation. Glass angled the white mask of her face to mine. Her black eyes swam in pools of deeper blackness. The Mistress Death. Something was battling within her. She enjoyed enlightening me about anything, but she did not enjoy being given orders by the effortlessly superior Lady Arryk.
An alien vehicle lodged itself at the base of the chasm millions of years ago. For years, before the wolves came, it was an open secret among some of the factions within the city. They even extracted the occupant of this vehicle and coerced it into, well, that's another story. But the technology remained buried under hard, packed rubble and the enormous pressure and toxicity of the chasm's base. Hard to reach, harder to extract. No one managed it in all the living years of the city. She cocked her head at the other woman. But Lady Arryk arrived with the tools and the expertise. She was meant to obtain armoring devices, the so-called Gideon Stones, for the purposes of our larger mission.
Did she? I asked.
Yes. Did she?
Glass echoed.
I said 9 have been extracted. That is not to say that 9 are in our immediate possession.
Lady Arryk regarded my captor, the demi-conjoiner about whom I now knew a tiny bit more.
We have one. You shall be shown it.
One? Glass queried.
I believe my diction was clear enough.
Glass nodded, accepting this news as a teacher might accept a poor excuse for late homework. For the first time I had a sense of the balance shifting between these two antagonistic allies, Glass seeing her chance to press a temporary advantage.
And the other 8? You're going to tell me where they are?
In Chasm City, or the ruins thereof.
Glass made an impatient snapping gesture with her fingers.
Give me the location. Scythe is atmosphere capable and still has a full weapons load.
If it were that easy, Hourglass, if it were a question of mere brutality, do you not imagine we would have already secured the remaining 8?
Lady Arryk breathed in through her nostrils.
There is a difficulty.
What kind? I asked.
Me, said Pinky, spreading his arms magnanimously. I'm the sticking point. I'm the reason she doesn't have the other 8 stones. And you want to know why?
He did not wait for an answer.
It's because she likes me too much. Somewhere beneath that scary, born-in-a-neutron-star space goddess exterior, there is actually a beating human heart.
I won't send them to die, Lady Arryk said. Not for 8 stones. Not for any stones.
Damned right, no one sends him to die,
Snowdrop said, and closed her hand around his again. Snowdrop was charged with showing us to our rooms. Even Glass accepted the wisdom of this arrangement, since it was far too much fuss to keep coming and going from Scythe without good reason. Besides, there were many rooms and, as I discovered, they were surprisingly well appointed.
We didn't furnish them,
Snowdrop said, keen to make this point as we were led through tunnels.
The rock is much as we found it, except for the extra security arrangements we put in around the lock. Lady Arryk mentioned that this place might have been illicit.
The hood was pushed all the way back now, allowing her hair to spill down onto her gown and shoulders in loose, colourless strands.
I think she's right. It was a gaming arena, built around a central core where various contests could be held.
The grey space beyond the windows in Overlook, I asked.
Yes, and I'll show you a little more of it after you've settled in. We'll eat later, and then you'll probably want to rest. Tomorrow, I'll give you the tour.
I'd like that. She looked at me doubtfully.
Really? It's a miserable fog-filled rock floating in space. Provided I could take Pinky with me, there are about 1 million places I'd sooner be than here.
You forget that for the last few decades I've seen almost nothing but the caves of Sun Hollow. A change of scenery. Any scenery. It reminds us of what we've lost, and what we've still to lose if we're not careful. I stroked my fingers against the rough-hewn wall, thinking of the fingers that had gone before my own. This place only existed because there was a society beyond it, a civilization of people and other worlds. The mere fact of it is something marvelous. Snowdrop made an equivocal noise.
It's been useful to us. That I won't deny. But what they got up to in here wasn't very nice.
I suppose you have some idea of what it was for?
There are some giveaways. The inner core, the arena, is very well shielded, in addition to the precautions built into the rock as owl. We think various sports took place there, and the rooms were for the spectators and bidders. It seems likely that some of the wealthy came with champions of their own. Sponsored talent, highly augmented warriors with a high degree of cybernetic enhancement, pampered prize fighters, willing participants to an extent.
Glass said, but not all of them?
From the evidence we've gleaned, it seems that on occasion, having a willing participant wasn't enough to keep the spectators engaged. So they spiced things up by bringing in an outsider.
I asked, an unwilling participant?
We can only speculate. What is clear is that the shielding in that arena would have been very hard for a distress signal to penetrate, even one sent by a Demarchist, Conjoiner, Ultra, or Skyjack. No neural alerts would have got through it, and the challenges that were deployed against these champions. Again, what we've seen of them point to a deliberate attempt to design weapons and traps that are inimical to those with a high degree of cybernetic augmentation. Neural weapons, nanotechnic weapons, things that would have made the melding plague look like an itch. We think they captured these poor souls, then let them loose in the core while laying bets on how long they'd last.
I shook my head. Just when I think I've imagined everything people can do to each other.
Wait until you hear about the swine house,
Snowdrop said. I thought back to the conversation in the Overlook. Is that something to do with Pinky?
In a manner of speaking.
I don't think he really took to me.
See it from his side. He was with the old man when he died. The old man trusted him with everything, including being the hand that wielded the blade that killed him. He looked up to him when the old man was alive and tried to walk in his shoes when he was gone. Hard for a hyper-pig, and now you show up in the old man's place.
I did not know whether to agree or disagree. If it's any consolation, I'm not trying to measure up to any man Pinky may have known. I don't even claim to be that man's brother. Glass and Lady Alec can say what they like. I know my past.
You know what you think you know,
Snowdrop cautioned. We had arrived somewhere, a pair of adjoining rooms. Glass in one, me in the other.
We still need to run those genetic verifications.
They kept back tissue samples from the old man. Probably Rose will be coming down shortly. You're not even sure if she's coming down or not? Glass asked, plainly resentful that her word alone was not being trusted with regards to my identity.
You'll see,
Snowdrop said. It might have been 200 years since the room last hosted a paying spectator. Nothing about the furnishings, though, suggested any comparable passage of time. Everything was clean and neither scuffed, faded, nor stained. The floors and walls were fleeced in grey and ruby, all other surfaces mirrored, and probably reconfigurable if I had the means to control them. And the bed was enormous. So were armchairs, settees, cabinets, and writing desks. They were decorated with inlaid designs, showing various exemplars of athletic prowess, martial combat, bloody dismemberment, and death. A bathroom as large as my entire office in Sun Hollow, tiled in shades of scarlet and bone, and with vein and artery drainage runnels worked into the floor. Power, light, and warmth. And all of these amenities to satisfy the tastes of men and women who, I was ready to believe, gladly collaborated in murder for sport. The only grace was that they were all almost certainly dead, and had probably perished in the same orbital firestorms that had turned 10,000 habitats to ash. I hoped their fun and games had been worth it. If the room allowed me to sleep and wash, it was enough. The rest of it I could ignore. I was clean enough, despite Pinky's protestations, and far too confused and anxious for sleep to be an option. But I was hungry and curious, and wondering when either might be sated. There was a knock at the door, followed immediately by the door's opening. A human woman came into the room, pushing a trolley. I sat down on the bed, watching her as she propelled the trolley softly and silently across the grey fleece. "Are you Rose?"
"No. Why would you think I was?"
Glass said that Rose was probably coming down to see me.
"That's not what she said. No and no."
"Yes. She would have said, 'Probably Rose is coming to see you.'" "Then you are probably Rose." I nodded, as if all this made instant sense. "Of course. How silly of me to have called you by completely the wrong name." She was middle-aged by my reckoning, with a narrow chin, pointed nose, and a lick of black hair combed across her brow. In place of her left eye there was a pattern of star-shaped stitches, drawing her skin drummed tight over an underlying emptiness. She wore an austere grey outfit of tunic and trousers, with her hands gloved. She wheeled the trolley to my side and whisked away a green covering, revealing racks of medical equipment and drugs, nothing of which I had seen before, but nothing of which looked entirely alien and unfamiliar.
"Roll up your sleeve."
"Why?"
"So we can tell who you are, yes?"
"I know who I am," I said patiently, as probably Rose prepared a syringe, her hand shaking more than I might have expected. "Nothing you can do or say will change it." She lifted the syringe up to her eye, the needle wavering perilously close.
"They don't care."
"I'm sorry."
"I'm saying, yes, they don't care what you think you are, so long as, yes, they know, yes and verily, that you are what they think you are, yes and yes."
Still holding the syringe, she used her other hand to slap the side of her head, palm first, not violently, but in the form of some mild personal chastisement.
"Yes and verily, yes, yes, your sleeve."
I rolled up my sleeve. "Why wouldn't they care?"
"Because, yes, you're useful to them regardless of what you think you are. Yes and verily."
Curiously, her hand became steadier as she advanced the needle towards my arm. She drew a small quantity of blood, efficiently and nearly painlessly, and then injected the syringe's contents into some kind of analysis device on the trolley. Machinery hummed and whirred, a centrifugal separator making the trolley wobble and the other items on it clink together.
"But you will remember, yes. You're the one. Yes, 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 and yes."
A string of lights was appearing on the analysis device, illuminating it from left to right.
"See it? Yes. Genetic correlation. Clavain left samples on Ararat.
Close familial cross-match.
Definitely you."
"I'm not." Probably Rose took a tissue scraping from inside my mouth.
"Almost redundant.
High statistical significance from the blood alone.
But blood can be swapped. So need to be sure, yes and yes."
Her hands were again shaking as she dipped the sample into another analysis receptacle, but they had been steady enough when she was extracting the tissue.
"From this, just this alone, yes, high likelihood you were born on Earth, Northern Europe, natural conception and parental gene mixing, early mid-22nd, which would make you, yes, 700 years old, calendrical, yes and verily."
I laughed aloud at the absurdity of what she had just said. "I would know if I was 700 years old, Rose."
"Probably Rose, not Rose. Always probably Rose."
"All right," I said, accepting her preference. "Probably Rose it is. What happened to you, probably Rose? How did you come here? Were you a doctor before?"
"Not a doctor, not a doctor."
She was preparing another instrument now, resembling a magnifying glass. She indicated for me to extend my arm and swept the glass along it, frowning intently as images and data streams played across the semi-transparent glass.
"Glass said you'd had it changed, yes?"
"Glass can say what she wants.
See those bone growths? Markers for osseointegration. You lost the arm, then had a mechanical graft."
She nodded to herself. Fits. Wartime prosthetics. Martian theatre. First conjoiner war. You just took blood from that arm. You had it regrown. Later methods. Maybe more than once. Multiple basal nucleation sites. She swung the hoop onto my face. Mixmaster genetic watermarking. Same with the eye. Lost it, replaced it, regrown it, several times over. Good match. Hard to tell. Glass has sold you a story. Now you're just seeing what you want to see. Run the same tests on yourself if you like. Yes and yes. And verily, nothing to hide. But you'll come to the same conclusion. She put away the scanner. Still need medicine, whoever you are. Do your bones ache? It'd be quicker if I told you which parts of me don't ache. Glasses, accelerated rejuvenation, yes. Tearing apart bones, musculature, nervous tissue. Rebuilding. Hard on you. These will help. She was preparing a concoction from the colored vials on one of the racks, pouring a little of each into a small beaker. And the monovores mean headaches. Ripping and reassembling synaptic connections. Like digging up the pavements of a city, putting in new drains and cables. We'll get better with time. But for now, drink. Since I had nothing to lose, I took the beaker she had filled and sipped at it cautiously, then with steady enthusiasm, and then swigged it with reckless abandon. I'll bet the medical systems on Glass's ship were at least as good as anything you have here. Yes, and verily. So why didn't Glass bother to give me something like this, just to take the edge off? Glass doesn't care what you feel, how you feel, just that you live. I finished the beaker, tilting the empty receptacle in the direction of probably Rose. But you did, seemingly. To you, in that case, unless you've just talked me into drinking a beaker full of poison. I watched her as she took the beaker from my fingers and placed it into an autoclave. Did you know Glass before now?
Nope, not crossed paths. Only knew what Lady Arik and Pinky said.
Then you're another of the people who were already here, in this rock.
No, not here, yes and verily.
She cuffed herself again. Something was not quite right in her head, I supposed. Some neurological gears kept sticking or going out of mesh. It explained the strangeness of her speech patterns, the shakiness of her hands, perhaps even the twitching self-admonishment, a kind of tick that reset herself.
Down in Chasm City. In the swine house. Yes.
What was the swine house? I asked gently.
Bad. Very bad. Yes, and verily. Bad, bad. Yes.
She cuffed herself twice, and I felt bad that I had made her revisit something painful.
But I got out. Yes, I got out. Probably Rose. Got out.
What happened there?
Not what happened.
She slapped herself hard this time, three times in rapid succession.
What is happening? What happens? What still goes on? Her swineness. Yes. Yes. Yes.
I reached out to grab her wrist before she hit herself again.
I'm sorry. Probably Rose.
Slowly I let go of her, and she rubbed her wrist where I had seized it too firmly, even as I meant to be kind. She looked into me with that single, wondering eye.
Are you a bad man? Warren Clavaine?
She had called me by that name and I had no desire to acknowledge it. But if Glass had driven a crack into my certainty, initiating a process of self-examination and re-identification, being in the presence of this other damaged soul had blasted that crack into a deep, widening fissure. It wasn't that I believed the evidence presented by the machines on the trolley, but I did believe probably Rose.
I don't know,
I answered, trembling in sympathy. And it frightens me what I'll find when I do. Chapter 12. We were called back to the Overlook for dinner. A long table had appeared since I was last there, with its major axis pointed at the slanted observation windows. There was still not much to see through them except suggestions of some formidably jagged terrain, crags and prominences, and ravines wrapped all the way around the inner core, but which were still mostly wreathed in mist and darkness. Lady Arik stood at the table's head, with her back to the window. Everyone else present was already seated, a dozen or so on either side. It was the first time we had seen most of them. Pinky and Snowdrop were nearest to Lady Arryk, but seated opposite each other. Two facing chairs were left unoccupied. Then came Cater, or Maury, and probably Rose, and then a weary-looking ensemble of pigs and humans, all of whom carried at least a scar or two.
"Be seated, please,"
Lady Arryk said, making a formal, stiff-arm gesture in the direction of the empty chairs.
"I imagine you will want to eat, but even if you don't, I have something you will want to see."
We took our places with a certain awkwardness, Glass eyeing me eyeing Glass, neither of us sure of our roles. Lady Arryk poured some wine into our glasses.
"They left us with the evidence of some extremely questionable activities taking place here," she commented. "They also left the contents of several well-stocked cellars, mostly untouched. Should our ethics forbid us from partaking, do you think?"
I lifted the glass and sniffed the bouquet. "My instinct would be to say, to hell with ethics."
"Then we are of one mind, Warren."
Lady Arryk sat down and scraped her chair forward.
"I must apologize for a certain reticence upon our first meeting. I had my doubts about your nature, and by extension I had doubts about Glass's judgment. I wondered if you could really be the man we sought. You seemed, on the face of it, somewhat unpromising material."
"But he is who Glass says he is," probably Rose said, looking around at the rest of the table.
"I've run the tests, all the tests, yes, and verily, this man was born in an insular territory of Northern Europe, Western Palearctic Sector, Earth, called—"
"My guarantee should have been sufficient," Glass interrupted.
"My dear Hourglass,"
Lady Arryk extended her hand in a show of charitableness,
"you are right, as I should have always known you would be. Your methods may be unconventional, even reckless, but you have always shown attention to detail."
Glass shifted in her seat. It was hard to tell whether she considered herself criticized or praised.
"Say what you will about my methods, but I wouldn't have sat around for 6 years doing nothing. Matters are complicated,"
Lady Arryk said.
"Nothing's complicated when you're willing to use the necessary force, unless you lack the nerve."
"Oh, the nerve isn't lacking,"
Pinky said. He took a quick glug from whatever it was that he was drinking, some clear spirit rather than wine.
"If force was the answer,
then why aren't we in possession of all 9 stones?
Glass demanded. I took a cautious sip of wine and set down my glass.
"Lady Arryk,
Glass, this isn't helping. It's not helping me, and I rather doubt it's helping any of your friends, who, incidentally, I have yet to be introduced to."
"You expecting it to be a long acquaintance, Stink?"
Pinky asked. I met his gaze and answered as reasonably as I could. "The truth is, I have no idea. But I thought a little civility wouldn't go amiss, until we've all agreed on the next step, whatever that is." Lady Arryk sighed.
"You are right, Warren, I've been a less than perfect host, and you have every right to know your new allies, as does Hourglass."
She extended a hand and began naming the figures who took up the other places.
"Bruno, Yilin, Cersini, Maud,"
until the names washed over me and I could only nod, trusting that it would not be too long before I committed them to memory. "From what I've gathered," I said, "some of you were on this rock before Lady Arryk arrived, and some of you have come up from Yellowstone. But the navigational beacon we found showed no ship movements other than the coming and going of Lady Arryk's shuttle. Those of you who arrived here from Chasm City must have arrived at the same time, on that last flight 6 years ago."
"That's correct,"
said the one called Cersini, a male pig who held a long-bladed knife in a leather-gloved hand, scratching the tip against the table as he scraped an outline around his other hand.
"We came up with the stone, those of us who made it out. Lady Arryk and Pinky saved us."
isn't one of us that won't carry that gratitude to our graves. Unless you were there, you won't know how bad it was.
Pinky said quietly, Lady Arik wanted to take the shuttle back down, to scoop up another load of survivors. I overruled her. 20 was all we managed. 3 didn't make it through the first week, even with probably Rose doing her best.
You were correct to overrule me, Lady Arik said. Even now I shudder to think how close I came to making that error. We had been lucky to make the movements we did without alerting the wolves.
Another flight in and out of that atmosphere would almost certainly have breached their triggering thresholds. Her fierce eyes latched onto me, and again I felt their intimidating scrutiny.
Then all you would have for dinner company would be ghosts. Sky Marshal.
First a new name, then a title. I suppose I'm going up in the world.
Count your blessings, Lady Arik said.
Then she reached forward and lifted the domed metal lid off the plate that was set before her.
Behold, the Gideon Stone.
In the middle of the plate was a lumpy, random-looking thing that appeared to be a half-fused nugget of ruby and chromium. It was larger than a fist, smaller than a human skull. It gave off a soft scarlet glow, underlighting Lady Arik's face. Lady Arik picked it up in her fingertips. She passed it to me, dropping it into my grip. I closed my fingers around it. The Gideon Stone was cosmically cold, heavy and dense, as if I had just palmed a lump of frozen space-time, folded and curdled in on itself to the quivering point of singularity.
It's active, Lady Arik said. It has its own energy source, its own activation protocols. We can control the stone to some degree, interfacing native human technology, integrating it into our defense systems. But the stone will always have a will of its own modes and temperaments.
Squeeze it tighter. Why? I asked.
Just do it, stink, said Pinky.
I redoubled my grip, humoring my hosts. I was expecting something to happen, and when the stone glowed brighter, its scarlet light bleeding out between my fingers, I wisely avoided dropping it. Then I felt a sort of cold, eruptive ooze emerging from the stone, as if I had cracked it and now its soft liquid contents were spilling out. The stone was intact. I had not crushed it, but something was definitely emanating from it. A pearly film was gloving my hand, creeping up towards my wrist. I felt nothing, no cold prickle or itch of contact. It was as if the film adhered close to the contours of my hand without making direct contact. A scale-like tessellation showed itself in the pearly film, hexagonal platelets jostling against each other.
Cesine, said Lady Arik, bring the vase.
Cesine scraped back his chair, reached for something beneath it, and came round to my back. Before I could move, Cater and Omori had me pinned down, unable to move or lift my arm where it rested against the table, my hand now lost within a faceted mitten of that spreading film.
Harm him, Glass said, and I'll send a direct neural command to Scythe to flood this entire complex with broad-spectrum nerve gas.
That would have the slight drawback of also killing you, Lady Arik said. Glass looked unconcerned.
I'd accelerate my mental clock rate enough to enjoy my last few seconds.
He shan't be harmed, Lady Arik nodded at Cersini.
We need him to unlock the riddle of Charybdis, but a demonstration of the stone's ability will make my point more readily than words ever could.
Do it. I writhed, but Cater and Omori had me immobilized. Rationally, I did not think it likely that Lady Arik would have any interest in seeing me injured. But I would have defied anyone to cling to rationality as they watched their hand being inserted between the two flat planes of a mechanical vice, the heavy item Cesini had kept beneath his chair. Cesini tightened the vice by means of a handle. It went around twice, then met the resistance of my hand.
As tight as you can, Lady Arik said.
Grunting with the effort, Cesini completed another turn of the handle. I had no doubt of the strength he was exerting. I could see it in the muscles and tendons of his forearm, bulging through the fabric of his sleeve,
but I felt nothing. The vice should have crushed my bones, but all I felt was a cold tingling. The pearly membrane that had come out of the Gideon stone was licking around the two jaws of the vice, enclosing them.
Harder?
Lady Arik demanded. Chassini growled back.
Any harder, and I'll shatter the vice.
I think, Glass said, that we may consider your point demonstrated, Lady Arik.
I concur, I said.
Chassini eased back the jaws of the vice until it could be released from my hand. The membrane clung to it, then relinquished its interest. It settled down around my hand again, but with the extreme edge of it still inching up my forearm.
Armoring skein, Lady Arik said, a defensive technology known to the grubs and carried by the member of their civilization who ended up crashed beneath Chasm City. We have no sense of how it works. We cannot even determine the consistency of that field, whether it's a form of mass energy or some clever self-organizing origami of space-time at the Planck granularity. All we know is that we can make it work for us. Release your grip on the stone. I did, watching as the membrane slithered back down my hand, losing its faceted texture and puddling eagerly back into the stone. The scarlet glow damped down again, the stone returning to dormancy. I massaged my wrist, more out of reflex than necessity.
Really? You could have just told me.
But now you know,
Lady Arik said, which will help you when you have to trust your life to it. What gets through it? When we meet the inhibitors, they won't be coming at us with knives.
Nothing in our conventional arsenal. Nothing that we've been able to test using our resources inside this rock. Cutting tools, projectiles, medium-yield laser and Bose discharges. Nothing breaks the field. Extreme pressure, extreme heat. Nothing touches it.
Glass made a scoffing sound.
Call me when you need some real weapons. The armoring skein is strong, but not invulnerable,
Lady Arik replied.
That we know. If the grubs were in possession of an infinitely powerful defensive technology, one of their kind would likely not have crashed on Yellowstone. It must have limits. If we breach those limits, we may lose the Gideon Stone, or even destroy ourselves. That we must not risk. Given these dangers, the only testing must be under conditions of fire.
Do you think this can resist inhibitor-level weaponry? I asked.
We cannot assume so. Perhaps it will offer short-term protection, but that is not what we are depending on. What you just saw, what you just experienced, was a demonstration of the Gideon Stone's ability to protect against extreme pressure. A mechanical vice, in this case, but it could just as easily have been the crush of a planetary atmosphere. An object, say a ship, could endure a great deal of pressure with the assistance of Gideon stones.
What sort of pressure?
Multiple gigapascals, she answered me. Many hundreds of thousands of atmospheres. That, at least, is what we must be prepared for, depending on factors yet to be decided.
I nearly laughed.
Dear God, I do not deny that the task is not without its challenges, but the thing we seek, the thing that the stones will help us find, may well be located at those pressures. We must be prepared.
But you've only got the one stone. Is that going to be enough?
Lady Arik shook her head once. Unfortunately not. The armoring skein has a limited effectiveness, a range of extent. One stone would provide for a small object, say a suit or a missile, but not a ship.
Then you'd better have an idea how we get the other stones, Glass said.
Lady Arik looked at Pinky. Tell them, if you will, the condensed version.
Pinky looked through me rather than at me, then at Glass.
We had an ally in the city who helped secure the nine stones. Unfortunately, someone in his organization betrayed him. Before we could get out of Chasm City, we were jumped by the Swine Queen. He was killed,
and she has the other 8 stones. Is she a pig? I ventured. No. Pinky's stare impaled me. Not a pig. A number of the people you see here, including probably Rose, were either prisoners of the Swine Queen or forced to work within the swine house. Some had escaped before we arrived, while others got out during the confusion and chaos of the operation. But many remain, and their lives must be considered in any future plans. I asked, will she give up the remaining stones? Not if threatened, Lady Arryk said. In fact, threatening her is the worst thing we could do. From her location, she would only need a few moments to dispose of the stones entirely, scattering them back to the base of the chasm, where we would have no hope of recovering them. That rules out any use of force, including surprise attacks. She directed a forbidding look at Glass. Even nerve gas. We have run every scenario. Even if we considered the lives of her prisoners to be expendable, no measure works fast enough to guarantee the preservation of the stones. There is a way, Pinky said. He finished off what was left of the spirit. I'm the price she's willing to accept. For me, she'll hand over the 8 remaining stones. What do you mean to her? I asked. We do not discuss this, Lady Arryk said. Perhaps it's time we did. Pinky shrugged, the oiled leather patches of his tunic squeaking with emotion. The Swine Queen got a good look at me before. Knows what I am. The oldest pig alive. That makes me valuable to her. Pig meat's rare, and I'm the rarest kind of all. She wants to cook and eat me. I shook my head in utter disbelief. She can't intend that. You bet your life she does, Stinky.
It's what she does, yes, said probably Rose. Keeps pigs, lots of pigs. Chained up, yes and yes. Fed and fed. Then she cuts them up, a bit at a time, and feeds them to the swineherds, yes and verily.
She looked down at her hands as if gripped by sudden shame.
I was her doctor, the one she kept. To keep them alive. Yes and yes.
She shuddered, but instead of probably Rose cuffing herself, Amori took her by the shoulders and hugged her until she was still. Even Chersini, the pig with the knife, moved to comfort her. It's abominable, I said. It's what she does, Pinky answered indifferently. And I'm the one prize she hasn't got her hands on. Oh, it's not just the way I'll taste, though that'll be part of it. I'm symbolic. A pig with real history, don't you know? I had a reputation in that city long ago. Makes me totemic. Take me down, and she doesn't just crush the hopes of the pigs left alive. She also sends a message to her rivals. Look what I did, everyone. I gobbled up the oldest living pig and robbed Lady Arryk of her loyalist deputy. She'll tape my screams, pipe them on repeat out to the rest of the city. And whenever anyone doubts her steel or thinks they can make a move on her, I'll get a replay. Just for old time's sake.
A pretty little impasse,
Glass said quietly. That's all you've got to say.
An impasse?
I asked, staggered by her detachment. She replied coldly,
I merely state the practicalities.
Lady Arryk will not countenance sending Pinky to his death. Therefore we do not obtain the stones.
Forever and ever.
She narrowed her eyes in the direction of the other demi-conjoiner.
Might I ask, was there ever a plan, or were you just hoping reality would go away?
The plan is to wait, Lady Arryk answered, with a thunderous calm. Factional warfare is rife in the ruins of Chasm City. The Swine Queen's position grows tenuous, as Pinky has indicated. Sooner or later she will overreach herself or be usurped by one of her deputies. Then we shall reopen negotiations.
Well, that's fine then,
Glass said. The wolves are at our door. The fires are going out. But we'll just wait. She stiffened, an idea presenting itself.
I brought checkers.
Would anyone like a game of checkers? Or we could play rock, paper, scissors, extinction.
Shut up, Glass,
I mouthed.
At last! A useful contribution from Stinky.
I nodded at the pig. There must be a way to get what we need. If the handover were to proceed, how would it happen?
No,
Lady Arik began. But Pinky was at least willing to entertain my train of thought. We set up the deal via optical laser, when the weather window allows. Might take weeks.
Agree the deal. Then we go down with the shuttle. Verify that the goods are authentic, on both sides. Then complete the exchange.
I nodded slowly.
Would she kill you immediately?
Not her style. Likes to drag things out. Crow over her victories.
He fingered the ruin of his ear. She might want to take another nibble out of me just for old time's sake. Once you've tasted pig, you don't go back.
He smiled at my evident discomfort. But one thing I'm sure of is that she'd want to make the rest of me last. I nodded, understanding how close he must have already come to becoming her prize, and what it would mean to go back.
Are we talking hours? Days? Longer than that?
Pass me a crystal ball and I'll tell you. What are you suggesting? I took my time before answering, sensing that I only had one chance to make my point, and that it was likely to be dismissed out of hand. If there were a way to go through the motions of the exchange, but still get Pinky back, oughtn't we consider it? I paused, waiting to be shouted down, or for Glass to encourage me on, but there was only an expectant silence. We have two ships now, not one. That opens up some possibilities, especially if Glass can operate without detection. Words were murmured, looks exchanged. Snowdrop seemed to be on the point of saying something, and Pinky seemed equally on the point of silencing her before she began.
Continue,
Lady Arik said. You make the exchange and leave with the stones. You get far enough away for there to be no chance of them falling back into the wrong hands. How long would that take?
We would only need to be airborne and out of the immediate range of the Swinehouse's guns. Say, a minute or two after departure.
Lady Arik's tone became harder.
Then what?
We go in hard with the other ship and extract Pinky. Element of surprise, while the Swine Queen no longer has any hold over the stones.
No,
Lady Arik said, shaking her head. This is still not feasible. You cannot be blamed for trying, but you do not understand the size of the Swinehouse, the overwhelming disparity in numbers. She has hundreds of armed underlings, and many hundreds more innocent prisoners in chains, waiting to be served. No shock attack, no matter how well mounted, will ever be sufficient. She only needs a moment's warning to kill Pinky, and by the time we go in, he could be anywhere inside the Swinehouse.
Fit him with a tracking implant, I said. He will be scanned at the point where we verify the goods. Any concealed weapon or device will be construed as grounds to abort the exchange.
She looked disappointed in me, as if she had seen promise, then seen it extinguished.
Do you not think we already considered this, Clavaine?
There must be a way, I pleaded.
There might be,
Glass said. She paused, enjoying her moment, Lady Arik hanging on her words just as tenaciously as the rest of us.
Go on, Lady Arik said. Inside Scythe is an archive of weapons systems, some of them highly specialized, some of them very old and barely used. There is a suitable option, a prototype but well advanced, synthesized and used correctly. It could serve as both weapon and tracking facilitator.
Were you not listening?
Snowdrop asked.
I was, Glass purred. The hemoclast is entirely undetectable. Unless your Swine Queen has access to a comparable archive of weapons and countermeasures, she won't be able to find it. This, I guarantee.
Pinky leaned in.
How does it work?
The hemoclast is concealed about your person. At an appropriate trigger, it deploys. Anyone near you who has not been marked as an ally or neutral party will die. The effective killing radius is large enough to form a moving bubble.
easily sufficient to shield you. You'd merely have to make your way to safety.
Not much use if I'm tied up and gagged, even less if I'm already turning on a spit.
The hemoclast can be configured to neutralize restraints.
It sounds promising, I allowed. Glass looked pleased with me.
Right answer.
No, Snowdrop said firmly, laying her hand over Pinky's.
We're not considering this. We don't know what the hell she's talking about, or how safe it is, or how effective. And meanwhile, you'll still be on your own against hundreds of blood-crazed swineherds.
We'd agree a rendezvous point,
Glass persisted.
Meanwhile, I would go in with Scythe's servitors and a spare suit. The hemoclast will guide me to Pinky. Once I reach him, the suit becomes his armor. We depart.
No,
Snowdrop repeated, but this time with less conviction. It was clear to all of us that every objection she raised would be quietly undermined by Glass.
If it means a way of obtaining the stones, and not losing Pinky, I said. The choice is simple,
Glass said, leaning back.
Act now, secure the objective, be on our way, or sit and wait for an opportunity that may never come.
This weapon, I said, Glass turning to me. If I'm not mistaken, the name you gave it means something like Blood Destroyer? Glass's face creased.
Clever boy.
In the morning, Snowdrop came to our rooms and told us to dress warmly and for rough terrain. My room, and I presumed Glass's was the same, had a huge and well-stocked wardrobe, capable of catering to every size and body shape. I put on two pairs of trousers, three underlayers over my upper body, a padded vest and a heavy belted coat with a fur-lined hood, with pockets for gloves and mittens. I found sturdy boots with pleated treads, a good fit over two pairs of socks. Predictably, Glass disdained any clothing beyond the inner suit layer she had been wearing since our arrival.
You'll catch your death, I said. Don't sound so enthusiastic about it.
Snowdrop appraised our arrangements with a disinterested sniff.
Lady Arryk wants me to show you the inner core. Your preparations are your own concern. I'm not responsible for any harm you get into in there.
Snowdrop was about as well layered as me, with a number of belts, pouches and holsters about her, as well as tools, knives, grapples, and a line of rope slung around her shoulder.
You were the one who said you'd show us around, I said.
I did,
Snowdrop said,
but that was before I got to know you better.
Then what's the purpose of this, if it isn't a bit of friendly sightseeing? Snowdrop glared at me.
You know what, old man? You ask far too many questions.
There had better be a point to this,
Glass said warningly.
Take it up with your scary half-sister. I'm just doing what she tells me.
I thought you didn't do orders, I said.
You're right,
she snapped back at me.
I just follow strongly worded suggestions. Good enough for you?
Knowing when to hold my tongue, at least temporarily, I let Snowdrop lead us through a warren of tunnels and shafts until we were back into the weightless part of the rock, which accounted for most of its volume. A set of heavy, lock-like doors allowed us to enter the inner core, which was still as gloomy and mist-wreathed as when I had seen it through the observation windows. We were weightless, but not drifting. A series of handholds and guidelines had been stapled into the face of a crag, and Snowdrop indicated that we should never lose contact with any of these aids. The air was cold and humid, and within a few minutes a clammy chill had worked its way into my clothes. I was glad of the layers I had put on, and wondered if Glass was having second thoughts about her insouciance. We traversed the crag, gradually working around a prominence. There was no real up and down, now we were weightless, but the way the rock formations jagged out from the circular walls, grasping towards the middle, made me suspect that the entire core had been designed to be rotated, providing gravity. The overlook was on an independent axis, though, so it was quite possible that the gravity in the core could be made higher or lower, depending on the wishes of the clients. We could see the overlook now, looking back towards the way we had come in, a protruding feature on the rim of a slow-grinding wheel, turning against a circular backplate. The lights were on in the overlook, a tiny but imperious form regarding us.
Lady Arryx had time to think about your suggestion, Clavaine,
Snowdrop said, at last breaking the silence.
She believes there may be some mileage in it, especially when allied to the weapon Glass tells us she can provide.
I shivered. I don't want to influence any decisions you have to take about the Swine Queen.
Then why did you suggest the course of action?
I thought it was something you might have considered already and wanted to know why it wouldn't be feasible, for my own satisfaction.
Is he always this bad a liar, Glass?
He knows better than to try in my presence. Of course he meant to put that proposal forward. It's the soldier inside him, breaking through to the surface.
Ready to send another man to his death, if it means achieving an objective?
He's understood enough to know that we must have the stones. Snowdrop halted. She was ahead of us, negotiating a crumbling ledge-like shelf, the mist-cloaked void all around. Despite the absence of gravity, my stomach kept turning, convinced that I was on the point of falling. I had not felt this way in the belly of John the Revelator, but that had been an artificial space, made of machinery. The crags and abysses of this tormented landscape snagged ancient parts of my brain, tricking it into thinking that there must be an up and a down.
Be still,
Snowdrop said to us. Slowly she drew a weapon from one of her holsters. The grip was shaped for a pig's hand. She thumbed a safety catch, made lights glimmer in the weapon's dragon-carved muzzle. Movement caught my eye. Something compact, fast and scuttling, passing between two shadowed clefts on the next crag over. I tensed, all my expectations undone. I had assumed that the core was abandoned, empty of anything that might harm us.
I sense it, Glass said, a machine presence, prickling against my implants.
It may take a particular interest in you,
Snowdrop said, tracking the scuttling form until it disappeared into mist.
We've destroyed most of them, captured others, but there are still a few dozen running loose in here.
What are they? I asked.
9 cats. Small robot hunter-seeker units, part of the games they used to play in the core.
Are they dangerous? I asked.
Snowdrop nodded. Very much so. Don't be fooled by the size. They've also got a very particular lethality where the likes of Glass are concerned. They're drawn to cybernetic systems. The augmented champions who faced them had prosthetics, neural enhancements, built-in weapons, but still the mortality rate was high enough to make for some very competitive wagering.
Something flashed into view, much closer. It was on the same formation of rock as us, further along the ledge, and coming closer with a sinuous, scuttling efficiency. It had a featureless, oval, matte silver body, with fine segmented arms radiating from it, tapering down to needle-like points. It was perhaps a meter across, from arm tip to arm tip. It was impossible to count the arms as they moved, but from the name alone I suspected that there were 9. Snowdrop let the 9 cat come a little closer, then blasted it off the crag. I watched it tumble off into the void, legs thrashing. If she had meant to destroy it utterly, she had made a mistake with either her yield or aim. But perhaps destruction had not been her intention.
Do you still sense them, Glass?
Snowdrop asked.
Yes. 2 in our immediate area. Several more at the limits of detection. They have sharp little minds.
Lady Arryx wanted you to see them. After Clavaine's suggestion last night, she wonders if they might be useful to the operation.
Snowdrop lowered her weapon, but refrained from safing or reholstering it.
Have you tried to control or reprogram them?
With limited success. Lady Arryx might have the capability, but as she would be the first to admit, her experience with military-grade cybernetic systems will never be as thorough as your own. After all, you are one.
Whether this was meant as insult or flattery, Glass was completely unfazed by it.
You say you've captured some?
About 120. Some damaged. We keep them locked up very securely, as you can imagine. If they were to break out, they'd very quickly overrun us.
We're also reluctant to allow Lady Arryx too close to them, in case they hurt her or otherwise find a way into her head.
I should like to see them.
Don't overestimate yourself, I warned.
I tried, but for some reason I keep failing to find my own limits.
Lady Arik will show you the 9-cat cache. If you can override their built-in patterns, they may be useful against the swinehouse. They can move quickly and slip through very narrow spaces.
They may be useful. It will depend on the time we have.
In a day or so, Lady Arik will attempt to use a signalling laser to establish dialogue with the Swine Queen. There's no point attempting it until then. The weather is much too impenetrable.
There's something else, too.
Go on, I said. We have eyes and ears sprinkled around Yellowstone.
Sensor motes Lady Arik deployed when she first arrived. Now and then they pick up on wolf activity. Individual cubes are too small to be detected, but when they begin to form into aggregates, our network stands a better chance of seeing them. The ultra-low frequency alerts have begun to trigger in the last 26 hours, and especially since you docked.
We did nothing,
Glass said indignantly,
other than create a commotion near that tracking beacon. I'm afraid that may have been all it took. The wolves have been roused to an additional readiness level.
Cubes are warming up, beginning to aggregate.
Some organized movement, precursor flows. Left to itself, and with no other provocation, it will likely die down. That's what always happens. But signaling Yellowstone risks another escalation. Never mind actually going down there, if the Swine Queen agrees to the trade.
Single-handedly, Snowdrop took something from her belt, then offered it to me.
Clip yourself in.
It was a loop of metal with a spring-loaded fastener. Wordlessly, I fixed the loop onto my coat, hitching it around the belt. A line ran from the loop, floating loose for the moment. Snowdrop had the other end of it, wrapped around her waist a few times, but otherwise held slackly.
He's mine, Glass said.
Snowdrop jerked the muzzle at Glass.
Keep out of this.
What's this about? I asked. Snowdrop kicked me away from the crag. I flailed, but within a moment the handholds and wires had already drifted out of reach. I was floating away at about a meter per second. Snowdrop playing out the line as the distance increased.
I was ready to give you the benefit of the doubt,
Snowdrop said, her voice turning hollow and echoing as the space between us increased.
Ready to go along with whatever you brought to the table. But you put that idea in Lady Arik's head. Now she's going to send Pinky down to the swinehouse. And it's all because of you.
The mist was already clouding my view of Snowdrop and Glass, the latter wisely keeping her distance. I wouldn't have proposed it if I didn't think we had a means of making it work. No one's talking about sending Pinky to his death.
Your conscience is clear, then.
No, it's not. But this is war. We need those stones.
They haven't even told you what they need them for.
They haven't needed to. It's obvious enough to me that we need them to strike back against the wolves. How is for another day.
That's simple.
It is, actually. The wolves will find and kill us all eventually. It's just a matter of time. Nowhere's safe unless we go back to the trees, and maybe even then they won't stop. Without the stones, there's no future. We all die, or our children die, or our grandchildren do. There was a tug as the line reached its present limit. The mist had closed in almost completely now, offering only furtive glimpses of the crag and the two watchers.
I could cut you loose now, Clavaine. Say it was an accident. Lady Arik can't see a thing from the overlook, not with this mist. And do you think she'd doubt me over Glass?
You'd gain nothing.
I'd gain you not pushing a stupid, reckless idea that could get Pinky killed. We were doing fine until you showed up.
Fine doing nothing,
Glass murmured, evidently unable to help herself. Not helping, I shouted back at her.
You see Pinky, and all you see is a pig,
Snowdrop said.
Maybe you think you see more than that. Maybe you tell yourself that you're not like all those other men and women who see something less than human.
Other than human, yes, but not less than.
I see a man, I said, a man with pig genes in him, but still a man. His being a pig isn't the issue here. It's that she has something we want, and she happens to want him in return. Snowdrop shook her head slowly.
Sure,
It isn't the issue.
I can attempt an intervention, Glass commented. I'd rather you didn't, I called back. Then to Snowdrop. Those nine cats wouldn't take long to find me, would they?
When they did, though, you'd have the consolation of it being a relatively quick end. Quicker than being cut up and cooked a piece at a time by some cackling lunatic.
You wouldn't kill me. Not after all the trouble it's taken to get me here.
I've told you I would.
The line went limp, momentarily, and I had a horrible intimation of falling, of being sucked into the mist. But the line retightened, and I saw that Snowdrop had released and snatched it again, quite expertly. I don't want to die out here, Snowdrop.
And I don't want Pinky to die down there.
He won't, I promise you. And I hesitated, conscious that there could be no going back once the words were out of my mouth. I'll guarantee that. I'll guarantee it by going down there with him.
Anything that he says now is under duress, Glass said, and therefore void.
Shut up, I replied.
Yes, shut up,
Snowdrop said. We agree on that much, at least, I said, trying to find a scrap of common ground. A little Glass goes a long way.
You mean what you just said? About him not being alone?
Yes, I said, then with more emphasis. Yes, you have my word on that. I'll not let him down. I'll not let you down. Pinky comes back with me and we keep the Gideon stones.
Understand this.
I'm listening.
Pinky can come back on his own, or the both of you can come back. Either outcome's acceptable to me. But if, for some reason, he doesn't make it out, you'd be doing yourself a great favor if you never saw my face again.
The line jerked again as she hauled me in.
Because I'd make you pay. And the things I'd do to you would give the Swine Queen night terrors.